This is CliffCentral.com.
Richard, are we on track with the financial pack for my presentation to the board next week?
Well, hopefully. The team's very short-staffed, and it's taking such a long time to find a suitable financial manager for the division. We're way behind on all our forecasts and reporting.
Why don't you speak to the finance team? They're a consultancy that can help you with an experienced interim financial manager. You can have somebody to help you almost immediately. They'll hit the ground running with no long-term contracts and no upfront placement fees.
Go to thefinanceteam.co.za.
Welcome to the business section of our Business Masterclass. I'm Richard Angus, CEO of the Finance Team, your part-time financial executive solution. Joining me in studio as part of our panel is Leandi Streeter, business coach and guide from Raise Corp, and Cynthia Schumann of the Ethics Monitor. Thank you, ladies, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Our guest on the line is no stranger to the South African environment, Wayne Dionach, chairman of OTA. Wayne, thank you for taking the time to chat with us.
Lovely to be with you.
So, Wayne, the reason we wanted to have a conversation with you is the first part of our show was really focused on the whole question of the need for ethics activists in our society. And we could think of no better example than to showcase OTA for the work that you guys have done. And if I may just preface this conversation with saying how impressed I have been with the efforts that OTA has made. I mean, if I look at the, you know, initially I think everybody always thought, you know, this is just about toll roads. But if I look at all the work that you have done over an extended period of time, you know, I had a look at the projects you're involved with right now, state capture, the communications environment, energy, government policy, various government policy elements, obviously transport and water and environment. I just looked at that list and I thought, sure, okay, you definitely are, you know, to have taken this to a whole new level in terms of engaging with the South African environment and doing what needs to be done.
Yeah.
So, Wayne, just give me some insights. I mean, when OTA started out, I mean, how did this start? Where did the idea come from? How did you get dragged into this? Well, just give us some great background just for our listeners.
Okay, so right in the beginning when the ETOL situation developed, we could see that something was fundamentally wrong. And when I say we, it was the car rental industry. I was the CEO of Avis at the time and chairing the car rental body. And nothing made sense to us, and we gathered also to the public, the unions, political parties. There was quite an uproar, but nobody was doing anything, and our industry got together and said, look, we can't keep shouting. We've got to challenge this. We've done our research, and we could see that they'd broken our constitutional rights as motorists and businesses, and believed that it required a legal challenge. But firstly, we engaged for a whole year with SANRAL, trying to get some sanity into how the system worked, because it was going to impact negatively not only on our businesses, but we started to learn more and more on other businesses and then the public. And then we had to make a stand, and we got together as an industry and put the money together for the first court case, which interdicted and halted the launch in 2012, in April 2012. And from there it's grown into, you know, we were asked very often, why didn't we take our fight order? And we said we would, but we can't do it without employing the right people, getting the talent into the system, and building our own legal team, because that was important, that we don't spend a lot of money on lawyers, external lawyers, and also that we work a lot faster on building legal cases. And when we got the finance model right, which was a crowdfunded model, mm-hmm. where thousands of people give 100 rand or so a month, and small businesses give a bit more. So we were able to start employing the people. And we grew from this time 2 years ago, four or five people. We had now 40, just under 40 staff, a legal team of six plus an advocate to heads it up, investigators, researchers and communications team. And we've now set out to challenge that which has to be challenged, which is the abuse of authority when it comes to maladministration and corruption. And it is about going after the individuals and the people who are responsible for it, holding them to account, and doing it properly and professionally.
Yeah, exactly. And I think for me, the reason why, No, Ota obviously has such high value and is held in such high esteem is the very professional way in which you've engaged society as well as government and other other affected parties. I mean, I think if I look at some of the stuff that has gone backwards and forwards between different entities and corporate entities and people, etc., in the public domain and in the media, etc., I think it is really easy to almost stoop to the lower levels and kind of get into the mudslinging. And I must say the one thing that has always impressed me about the Ota response is always the calm, fact-based engagement that is clear, concise, sets out the issues quite clearly. I think, I think your invitation, for example, on the ETOL scenario with Sanrail to say, okay, well, bring your test case. Let's do the test case. We're happy to live with the findings of the judiciary and the likes.
Yeah.
I think speaks volumes of the type of people that the guys within OTA are and the type of thing that you wish to represent from an activism perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the circumstance, we've got to be sure of our facts. And it's not about poking a stick at government and picking a fight for the sake of doing so. This is about asking government the real hard facts around, is what you're doing in the best interest of society? If it isn't, then you need to be challenged on it and questioned. And we see a lot of that at the moment. I mean, if you just look at the carbon tax, for instance, it's not about us wanting to say, well, people just spew emissions into the atmosphere. It's about making sure that if you introduce a carbon tax, that you do it in a way that changes behavior, but the money is used to continue with greener innovation so that the planet can be better invested in, and that it's not just about putting money into government's coffers for squandering. And the same goes for, we're looking at NHI now. I'm saying, yes, the poor have to have good free medical supply and attention, but the way they're going about it is just absolutely ludicrous. It's crazy. It's going to fail, just like the ETOL scheme. And so we're trying to hold government to account for good governance, good policy, and sensible governance.
Mm. Now, Wayne, I mean, the whole world of being, let's call it an ethics activist. It's a term we've coined and used. Cynthia's come up with this terminology. How does it feel? I mean, you obviously are synonymous with OTA. Your personal brand and OTA are kind of inextricably linked, obviously. How does this play out for you at let's call it a personal level, in your interactions with people, etc.? How do people react to you as, let me call it, the face of OTA as the ethics activist?
Well, I don't know, because we just continue to do what we've got to do. We work at a very, very fast pace. It's broader than me now. We've got more spokespeople in the various areas. And I guess what it means for us is that we've got to ensure that our governance is right. And, you can imagine growing an organization from 3 to 40 staff in 2 years. Our policies and procedures have to change fast. We've had to put in structures, new people, and with that comes its own challenges. I mean, we even have our churn in that growth, because people come in at areas that aren't right and either can't move up or need to move out, and we even get challenged internally. So we're not unique to any organization that comes with its pressures of rapid growth. And that's been good for us, because it tests us and says, right, we've got to make sure that our governance space and our ethics are in place. And we've had to keep looking internally as well as looking externally as we've grown. So we've come a long way, and we're growing as fast as we can. And I guess people look at us as an organization that is driving an ethical and moral stance, but we've also got to watch ourselves.
Yeah,
because you can't get high on your own juice in this game. You can't think that you are now the power base that you are, or the be all in this space. You've got to you can't suffer from the same problems that government suffers from, where it starts to think that it can't be challenged. We've got to be challenged as well.
In fact, I would argue that once you're in the space of if you want defending what is ethical, you almost become, I use the word target in inverted commas, but you almost become more of a target that for your slightest misdemeanor and then the sort of employee who is just mildly dissatisfied, you would almost be criticized more fiercely because your work is supporting ethics.
Absolutely, you're quite right, and that we've been encountering in the last number of months as we've had to go through some tough decisions on internal challenges that we've had to look at and press ahead. And you're quite right. I mean, if we are pushing the envelope too far, we're going to get challenged both internally and externally. So we're watching that all the time, and it's not that it's a perfect world. And it's not, you know, ethics and governance is not an on-off switch. It's a journey, and you've got to keep reinventing yourself, keep making sure your structures are right, your appointments are right, and that you're following due process, while at the same time challenging externally for exactly the same thing. So you're quite right. I mean, we've had to watch that very, very closely.
In fact, if I can add to what you're saying, certainly in terms of my work in the ethics space, I've often found, and I'd be interested in your comment, I've often found that the internal management of ethics is often something that's reactive, a bit ad hoc. So as much as the outer statements external statements might say all the right things, that often that internal management of ethics is not nearly up to speed enough. So as I say, I appreciate you just talking to the point, but I wonder if that's also your experience.
Yes, absolutely. As I said earlier, growing at that pace, you know, when you're a 3 or 4 man organization, you don't have the extent of the policies and procedures in place as formally as they should be. And as you're growing and you're putting them in place, so you become stretched. Mm. And as you are growing and people who come in at certain levels can't grow with you, there's a lot of frustration. There's pushback, and then you get questioned on whether you're bringing people in at the right levels. So we're not without our challenges internally and having to watch our own ethical space and how we manage people. And I can assure you that we've had our challenges, but we work through them, and we work through them diligently and give a lot of room for movement so that we can just make sure we do it properly and get better. And the thing is, you've got to be a learning organization. Mm. You've got to
indeed
take from every step and learn and put in place the new processes that make you stronger.
Yeah.
Now, Wayne, I mean, if I have a look at the number of issues that you've got involved with as OTA, I mean, clearly you've put yourselves on the radar quite publicly with certain elements that could potentially be quite tough to deal with in terms of, you know, they have vast resources at their disposal, and they're quite, use the word carefully, aggressive in their pursuit of certain outcomes. Do you find this, I mean, does the transparency that you enjoy as an activist, where you basically put it out there, so to speak, does that give you an element of, let me call it, protection against, you know, let's call it the individuals in question? Or, you know, do you sometimes have concerns, and how do you sleep at night knowing that, you know, you've been, you're engaging, I mean, let's just be straight, you know, people like the presidency. I mean, let's be honest, this is not for sissies.
Yes. Well, that is exactly it. You know, you can't come into this space and then be concerned. Obviously, you can't be reckless. You've got to be guarded, but you've got to say it right and do your research and be careful. Be very careful how and what we say. So if it means laying charges against the president, laying treason charges, as we've done against the Faith Mutambi and Richard Zwani and Seleke and people like that, these are people in the highest levels of government, plus lower down, you don't do so willy-nilly. You get your facts, and you double check them, and then you go ahead and you do it because it's right to do, not because you just want to do something. And we believe that tackling corruption and maladministration at the highest levels is where you start, because when you start fixing it there, and this starts to permeate downwards, then you know that you're going to fix the problem for the longer term. It's like pruning the tree from the top. There's so much to do at the bottom, but it's at the top where the greatest attention is actually to focus sometimes.
Yeah, well, getting rid of the supplier of the brown envelope is always a good way to start cleaning up cleaning up town for the sheriff.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, and I use the analogy now of saying cleaning up the town with the sheriff. Does it feel sometimes that you're a little bit in the wild west of the good old days, where it's a bit of the gunslingers taking pot shots at everybody and things getting a little bit. A little bit hair-raising occasionally. I mean, if I just look at early in December, I saw there was news commentary that our dear friend at SAA, there was, talk of, there's going to be some changes around Dudu's role. She's now going to become, if I remember, a special advisor in the Ministry of Transport. Oh, and they're going to shift SAA from the Ministry of Finance to Transport, and suddenly the papers, if I recall the headlines as I drove down the road that day, was, and SAA's back with Dudu, was the kind of thing. And I kind of look at this and I go, sure, a lot of effort and a lot of focus. You've clearly focused them and focused South Africa and the public's eyes on this, and yet right in front of you, they're now going to, they're thinking of trying to do something. I mean, I see now that I saw within a matter of a few hours, the presidency issued a straight flat denial of no, that's not going to happen. It's not moving from finance to treasury, from treasury to transport. It just blows my mind that, somebody would stand up and say, I'm employing Dudu as an expert at R1 million a year salary, and I'm going, what, an expert in how to run a company into the ground? What expertise are we talking about? Could you be more specific? Was a really scary scenario that they had play out there.
It is.
These people seem quite brazen in some of the stuff that they get up to. How does that make you feel as an activist and trying to do the right thing?
It's frustrating. It is clearly that it's sheltered employment. She's not an aviation expert. She's got no idea. The fact that she sat on that board and ruined that organization doesn't make her an expert at all. And when you see CIPC have sanctioned her in the past, we have a delinquent director case coming up at the end of the year in November 2018. Should be in court regarding her. So there's sufficient evidence to show that this is just a farce, and this is a message coming from the top saying, find some employment to keep this lady busy. And if Joe Masangani, the transport minister, sees her as an expert, well, then so be it. That just goes to show the level of the problem, really, because then he is so out of touch with reality when it comes to running transport. But we've seen that anyway. And we've just got to carry on and soldier ahead and not allow that to put us off and to deter us from keep doing our job.
Exactly. And I think one of the things, you spoke to it earlier, you said you're quick and reactive and responsive and you got that nimbleness. And then I hear you now say, okay, and this is going to end up in a court case in November of 2018, later this year. Mm-hmm. And I kind of go, sure, that must be hard to almost have the public's back as an activist saying, this is wrong. And then it's like, yes, and we can prove it when you give us a court date in a year's time, kind of thing. You're talking November 2018. We're talking, 11 months away before that. And I mean, I'm sure that delinquent director conversation was happening in 2017. So, it's more than a year to get court actions on fundamentally a person that is blowing billions of rands away on a monthly basis. You know, where's the sense of urgency from the judicial kind of, you know, I'm kind of asking myself the question, like, where's the special court here to hear things that are in, let's call it, public interest? You know, if you're blowing, if somebody's blowing a billion rand, you know, a month or two, surely to goodness the court can get it together faster than, you know, 12 months later.
Yeah, look, unfortunately, this is how it works in some cases. Others, we can bring urgent interdicts, as we did do with the BNP Capital case. We got the information from the whistleblower and halted that case from when we got first wind of it, and then halted it. That took us 6 to 8 weeks, and that's the nimbleness of what we can do in case building. But in other matters like this, where it's not an urgent application, unfortunately, if you put applications in for the High Court, that can take 18 months, and you've got to also build your case before that. So we started working on the Dujanyeni Delinquent Director case beginning of 2017, and I'll see its time in court in the end of 2018. But this is the other side of fighting corruption, is you've got to have the patience, you've got to have the long-distance journey of raising the funds for these matters and staying the course. This is, you know, fighting corruption and maladministration and government misspending is not an overnight process, and that's why we've just got to keep building the support for ATA so that we can take on more and more cases. And they take years, some of them, but it's worth it in the long run. I can assure you, when we get that judgment, and we're quite sure about that, that she pays the penalty, and she will not be able to sit on any boards thereafter, and not be able to fill these important positions, and then from there will come the criminal charges, and eventually, you know, jail time if need be.
The lovely orange is the new black.
But I think I grant you that the time does appear to be unduly long. But for me, the importance of this speaks to the current sense of impunity. And I think that one's got to knock a hole in that with saying, actually, we pursued this matter and here is a real outcome. And I rather suspect that without that outcome, it would be almost impossible to find the impetus to keep going. But I mean, can I feed back to you that the resilience I'm hearing in terms of you keeping going at it, I think is really noteworthy. And I think it speaks to what must be a core dimension of many of our really good active civil society organizations.
You've got to build these organizations for the long term, and to do that you've got to have good people and continuity, and to do that you've got to pay market related salaries, and to do that you've got to have the funding and the backing, and the models are different for different civil society organizations. Some rely on the handouts and the support of big donor organizations. You know, you'll get 3, 4, 5 of them, but the problem with that type of organizations that you lose one supporter organization, billions goes, and you have to retrench. Whereas what we like about our model is that the public are behind us, and we call it crowdfunding for South Africa's prosperity. And when tens of thousands of people give you small amounts of money, and you keep growing that, and you remain relevant to them because they can see your progress year after year, so you can take on more. And it's that journey, it's this wave that we just continue. And as some cases close, we take on new cases. And as we grow, so we put more people on board. And it's a nice formula. And we built this organization for the long run, and we're actually having a lot of fun doing it because there's a massive amount of energy and a buzz and excitement on the outer offices where as we lay new charges and as another case comes to fruition, the energy's high and a new milestone is reached. I can assure you it's really, really exciting stuff what we do there.
Well, I was going to say, when unfortunately for us as a country, you don't seem to be in short supply of work.
No, well, that's unfortunate, because we shouldn't exist, you know,
Yeah, I was going to say, the sad thing is you're so passionate about what you do, and the sad thing is that, in fact, the fact that you exist as an organization is an indictment on the environment. But look, from our perspective, from the show, we can definitely we add our endorsement to your cause in terms of a funding appeal, and in the one thing we will do actively on social media as part of our show and the promotion of the podcast on the show after this, we'll actually actively engage people to donate, because I do believe, and become members of OTA, because I do believe this is something where if the whole of civil society gets behind doing the right stuff, the reality is that then people who have any inclination to do anything to the contrary will actually be kind of put in a corner and painted. And I think for me that's the important thing, is that, you know, as they always say in their classic saying, you know, you've got the brush and you've got the paint, Mr. Whoever or Mrs. Whoever. If you decide to paint yourself into a corner, I can't really help you. And ethically, I think, you know, the ethics and the issues that we're seeing in this country, I mean, people just paint themselves into corners all the time. And I kind of look at this and I go, you know, do you guys not realize what you're doing? You know, there's a part of me that almost goes, you know, is everybody that naive to think that this is acceptable? Do we have a different value set as you know, civilization, and other people have different value sets? But I mean, I must say that I, no matter who I talk to across, you know, gender, race, age, you talk to anybody, they all have the same view, and we all seem to share a common set of views and values on this whole question of where these violations of ethical behavior happen. And you know, I kind of look and go, how do people actually I struggle to know how they rationalize it and sleep at night and think that it's okay. It's just it's absolutely mind blowing. You know, I mean, I saw a joke the other day. I won't say who was the feature of the joke, but I'm sure you can figure it out. They said, you know, how does this person sleep? And the caption below said, like a baby. They wake up every 2 hours crying. But I mean, you wonder, do these people actually have a conscience? And clearly, you know, an activist like yourselves, like Ota, is engaging and almost, I guess you could say, forcing a conscience into the space. When unconscionable behavior happens, somebody has to bring the conscience to the table, and I guess that's the role of people like yourself and the team at OTA, to actually bring the, let's call it, society's conscience to the fore and say, no, this is not acceptable, and we're not going to take this, and we need to stop this right here, now. Wayne, it's been great.
Can't do as much as it is.
It's been great chatting to you. If I can give you one last opportunity, is there any kind of specific message that you, as the CEO of OTA, would like to get out there to the South African public, to make a bold statement around where we are ethically and where OTA is and what you're striving to achieve? This is an opportunity to do that.
I think the first thing is, we've got to be very careful as a nation that we don't slip into the state of depression. And one senses that this hopelessness and this frustration levels are very high, and people sort of give up and say, well, how do we fix this? But we can. I can assure you there are countries in Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, and many others that are tackling corruption, wide-scale, you know, deeply entrenched corruption head-on. And when society and governments do start walking together, and they will, because who's in today is not in necessarily tomorrow, and things do start turning, and the barriers that are in place now do get lifted, and we're able to go and challenge those and take them on and put them where they should be. That's the starting ground and the turning point for the improved prosperity that we see ahead. So we cannot give up. And when you give up, then we've lost, and you don't want to do that. So we say to the public, look, if you're feeling helpless, get behind organizations like ourselves, because we'll do that fight for you. We'll enable you to feel like an active citizen. And we'll be your ATA, we'll be your organization that takes on the corrupt. So get as many people behind as credible civil organizations, and it's not just ATA, there's Section 27, there's a number of them out there. Just do what you believe should be done, what is right, you know what is right, and let's see how we can move this country forward. And if we look back 5 years from now, I can assure you that from where we sit, we believe that the good has to triumph in the end, and it will, and this will be the best place to be.
Wayne, thank you very much for your time. We really do appreciate it. Thank you very much for your thoughts. That was our guest, Wayne Devenacher, CEO of OTA. Next up, the Youth Leadership Platform. Stay with us.
This is CliffCentral.com.